Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Matthew Wyss. Matt's the University of Laverne, California, professor of public administration. His public works and work and others show shadow government entities and state crimes against democracy undermine America's legitimacy and founding doctrine. Well, I've written a few things about America's founding doctrine. Oh, it is not quite what people make it out to be, but that's another issue altogether. Maybe we can discuss it in more detail on a future program. I've certainly written about it a few times. But we want to get into the issues that are on Matt's mind. There's so much going on domestically and on the global stage. Let me just make a couple of comments. I manage to get a fair amount of writing done every day. I don't think I'll get this one out tomorrow, but I wrote an article today I call Escalating Tyranny in America. I wrote two other articles recently and others, weeks and even months before that, about America, about Obama's kill list, his disposition matrix, making extrajudicial killing legitimate. There's no way you make extrajudicial killing legitimate. It violates international law, constitutional law, U.S. statute law. Well, of course, that doesn't bother America. America turns truth on its head. It does whatever it wants to do. It wants to kill somebody, target somebody, imprison somebody, do anything they want to anybody or any nation. It just does it. That's the way rogue states operate. Anyway, I'll have another article coming on that. I've got some other stuff I want to get out tomorrow. Let me say one more thing, too. Rogue states also suppress truth. Truth is sunshine. Truth. That defeats their rogue agenda, their imperial agenda. And there's no question that if enough people knew what America was up to and what it's doing, I just wonder what would go on. A little bit more disruptive things than are going on now. A fair number of people know. Most people don't. Most who do don't do anything about it. How do you get constructive change if you let the worst things go by that harm you personally and don't do anything about it? Moaning and groaning accomplishes nothing. Action, activism, that's what gets it done. But let me say a word about Press TV, because they were targeted again. Iran. I've got another article on Iran that I wrote. I'll get that one out. I had a new one that I put out today. I think it was today. Again, I get so many out, I forget what day I get them out on, but I think it was today. But I've got another one that hasn't gotten out yet, and I will get that one out. And in it, I discuss how Washington targeted Press TV. The heat was put on. It was done earlier. It was taken off two satellite networks, Eutelsat and Hispasat. Eutelsat, a European service. Hispasat, a Spanish broadcasting service. Iranian broadcasting was targeted again, and Press TV was targeted. Press TV is a marvelous service. We've talked about it on this program before. They have me on often as a guest. It's a great honor to go on because I can speak as freely on Iranian Press TV as I do on this program, as I do on my own articles. I have never once been invited on the U.S. scoundrel media. Never one single time. No National Public Radio, nor the Lira News Hour. And I once had a debate, a mini debate, with their ombudsman, and I challenged them to invite me on to speak about any issue they chose. I would go on blind. You pick the issue, you invite me on, give me enough airtime so I can get to a studio to be on with you, and I'll go on blind or whatever you want. They wouldn't dare invite me on. I'd wreck their whole program. I'd be on with a couple of scoundrels. I'd be polite. But I would say my piece, and I wouldn't pull any punches. Anyway, Press TV was blocked again. I watch it every single day. I wouldn't miss a day, but I missed it yesterday because when I went on their website, I saw a posting that said something to the effect that it was blocked. I checked again this morning, and it's operating. Anybody in America, I believe probably most anywhere. Well, I shouldn't say anywhere because I don't know how other countries operate. But in America today, probably across Europe, certainly in most other places, you can go online to Press TV. Just Google Press TV. You can go to Press TV, English language broadcasting. They operate 24 hours a day. And if you want real news and information, you can get it. You might even see me pop up every now and then. You'll see many other terrific guests. to come on and they tell the truth, and I listen to them, and I can easily separate truth from fiction, and they tell people what they need to know. Don't let a day go by without checking out Press TV. Hopefully, whatever was blocked will be unblocked and will stay unblocked. But I know the broadcasters there do their best to do the unblocking when America and the European rogues put the blocking in. And make no mistake, Israel is very, very much involved with this. Anyway, Matt, I welcome you to the program. I just had a few things on my mind I wanted to get off my chest. Let me give you a chance to talk about what's on your mind.
Not at all, Stephen. Always a pleasure to join you. And what a coincidence, the issues you raised in your opening comments there were very much what I wanted to talk about. If I could, I'd like to share with you a passage from a Thomas Merton essay, Letter to an Innocent Bystander. I became acquainted with this from hearing James Douglas giving a presentation on his work about the JFK assassination and how Merton's words are pertinent. Merton wrote Letter to an Innocent Bystander, it was back in the early 60s, I believe, and he was on a crusade at the time to bring to the attention powerful people the perils of nuclear war. Letter to an Innocent Bystander was an essay that he collected in this eventually in a volume, Raids Against the Unspeakable. It was provocatively titled. But he recalls the parable of the king's new clothes in this Letter to an Innocent Bystander, and that the common retelling of the story leaves out an original detail. Tailors deceive a king, telling him they will make for him a wonderful suit that's visible only to good people, and the tailors proceed to fit him out with clothing and nothing but their assurances that he is in fact wearing something. So they're flattering him, and the courtiers claim that they see the new suit. All the courtiers around the king claim, oh yes, indeed they see the new suit. And they comment on how wonderful it is. Believing his flatterers, as kings will do, he eventually parades into the street where onlookers gather and likewise praise his new clothes, except that there's a child in the crowd who dares to point out, you know, hey, the king's naked. And Merton derives the relevance of this story as follows. He says, "You will perhaps find that my thought has taken on a sentimental tinge, but since the times have become what they have become, I dare to blurt this out. Have you and I forgotten that our vocation as innocent bystanders and the very condition of our terrible innocence is to do what the child did and keep on saying the king is naked at the cost of being condemned criminals? Remember, the child in the tale was the only innocent one. And because of his innocence, the fault of the others was kept from being criminal and was nothing worse than foolishness. If the child had not been there, they would all have been madmen or criminals. It was the child's cry that saved them." And it seems to me that, similarly, apropos the comment you make about how America is becoming more and more blithe in its dismissal of truths that are very pressing upon us, that in a sense we've become complicit with those who flatter the king. You know, if what are those among us who are innocent to conclude about this reality? So those of us who are, as it were, innocent bystanders, I think most Americans would consider themselves innocent of the crimes of our country, or they would rationalize along with John Brennan in his recent in the recent proceedings of the Senate Intelligence Committee for his nomination to CIA director. I wanted to share with you a passage from that because it's as Orwellian as you can get. So I you know, where to go with this? You talked about extrajudicial killings. In response to Senator Angus King probing John Brennan, Here, could I share with you that exchange?
Oh, absolutely, man. And I sure had my say on John Brennan, but please go ahead.
Angus King, whom Jeremy Scahill, an interview on Democracy Now, sort of quips, must not have got the memo that he was supposed to, you know, declare how beautiful the King's clothes are on this. So he's direct. Angus King, Republican, says, here's transcript. Having the executive being the prosecutor, the judge, the jury, and the executioner all in one is very contrary to the traditions and the laws of this country, and particularly in a situation where there is time. If a soldier on a battlefield doesn't have time to go to court, but if you're planning a strike over a matter of days, weeks, or months, there is an opportunity to at least go to some outside of the executive branch body, like the FISA court, in a confidential and top-secret way, make the case that this American citizen is an enemy combatant. John Brennan, nominee for CIA director, longtime insider there, architect of the drone program and related assassination strategy. John Brennan responds, Senator, I think it's certainly worthy of discussion. Our tradition, our judicial tradition, is that a court of law is used to determine one's guilt or innocence for past actions, which is very different from the decisions that are made on the battlefield, as well as actions that are taken against terrorists, because none of those actions are to determine past guilt for those actions that they took. The decisions that are made are to take action so that we prevent a future action, so we protect American lives. That is an inherently executive branch function. You see this blurring between probable cause and unlimited executive authority. There's this slippage going on here in this exchange and throughout what, again, Scahill's quipping is apropos, I think, kabuki theater, or I think he called it kabuki hearings, where, for the most part, softball pitches are made by the Senate Intelligence Committee to Brennan, and where there ever is a hard question, as with Angus Kinn or Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, questions are not followed up. There is no, as it were, cross-examination. There's no drawing a conclusion to its, drawing out the reason to its logical conclusion. There's this sort of withdrawal from what the oversight committees are responsible for, which is a check and balance against executive overreach. And here we have something quite the contrary. This is Minority Report. This is science fiction. When a nominee for the most secretive agency of the land can declare that future actions are something that the executive branch, with no oversight, can adjudicate, we've entered a very, very strange new world. And it's not that Obama is worse than Bush was in this matter. It's that we see here very clearly a progression of unilateral authority, which is, Angus King really said it very clearly, judge, jury, and executioner all in one. This is star chamber with high technology. And, what to derive from that about how Americans ought to be thinking, responding, I think Americans are, for the most part, numb and heading towards deep cynicism, as under conditions of Stalin, where everyone knew, you know, the show trials were on. Everyone knew this was a farce. Everyone knew that the official story was absolute fraud. I think we're heading, I think America's heading to that level of cynicism. And it's very, very difficult to recover once you cross that line. It's very, very difficult to recover the social capital necessary to transact anything meaningful because people's trust about what constitutes valid information has been so ravaged. Recovering that is stuff of Old Testament storytelling. So I'm with you. I think there's on this matter of extrajudicial killings and related to unilateral authorities, the fix seems in. for instance, one other thing with regard to John Brennan, he, in this exchange with the Senate confirmation hearing, he repeatedly demurred, well, Senator, I'm not an attorney, so I can't tell you exactly the legal implications. But what I can tell you, dot, 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 is that everything we did was legal. In other words, it was vetted by attorneys, but I am myself not an attorney. Now, when civil servants, of which the CIA director is one, can demur that I'm not an attorney, therefore I don't have to answer a direct question, you know, we've got another sort of slippage. We've got this slippage in, it's not due process exactly, it's democratic good faith discourse. And that's another casualty of this kabuki theater known as our Congress in matters of, you know, sort of so-called counterterrorism. So we're not getting good faith, you know, from our civil servants in response to the body, nominally there, our only body, to represent our voice. And if that body then doesn't press the matter, it's hard to tell whom to turn to. And so I think a natural outcome of that is a kind of numbness, a kind of retreat, where the good people say, oh, yes, the king has a beautiful set of clothes, and good luck finding the innocent one who's willing to say, no, he doesn't. It may be that, you know, I think, as with yourself, as with so many people now online, blogging, radio shows that are fearless, that are willing to make fearless speech, you know, there are so many. They are like the innocent child, but like the parable of the tree that falls in the forest, if it falls and no one's there to listen, did it fall?
Matt, there's so much I could say to respond to all of your important comments. On the one hand, I remember Brennan's comment about wanting to stop future crimes that haven't taken place yet. There were so many logical responses to that. A simple one that popped immediately to my mind was, if I was one of the questioners, Mr. Brennan, are you claiming a power that I certainly don't have? I don't think anyone in this room has. I've never met anyone in my life has. I'm talking about the power of clairvoyance. You can literally tell in advance who plans to commit a crime, and you can act to stop it. Well, if you have that power, that's extraordinary. I suggest you use it. If you don't, I suggest you're committing crimes. As far as not being a lawyer, Matt, I'm certainly not a lawyer, but a fair number of my readers think I do, because I quote the law so many times. In the article I got out today that I call, this was my third one on Brennan. Recently, I wrote two or three earlier about him. I think at least three earlier about him. But this one is called Whitewashing Extrajudicial Killing. I started out citing the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person. Article 6 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, basically the same thing. Common Article 3 of the 4 Geneva Conventions, about the same thing in more detail. The Constitution's Fifth Amendment, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And I quoted the U.S. statute definition of murder. It says, murder is the unlawful killing of a human being with malice aforethought. If Brennan isn't guilty of that, if Obama isn't guilty of that, I'd like to know what the hell they are guilty of. They certainly are guilty of that. And anybody can look up these laws just the way I did. And they're in simple English. It doesn't take a lawyer to understand them or to quote them.
Where we get, thank you, Stephen, you know, where we get lawyered up is, as with a document like the Department of Justice white paper supposedly leaked to NBC News. And I've been scanning this so-called white paper. It's so larded up with legalese. It's virtually unreadable. There are a few passages that one can glean as sort of, you know, normal prose, from which you can pretty quickly derive this sort of, among other things, there's this repeated refrain of that force, that enemy force who, quote, poses an imminent threat. Imminent threat, of course, is precisely what Brennan refers to differentiating law for crime after the fact from executive authority before the fact. And this ruse of utilizing so-called imminent threat, and from what I can tell in several pages reading, never pinning down, defining just what constitutes an imminent threat, is again part of the tissue of fraudulent symbolism that this legalese, this lawyered up documentation sort of permits in a roundabout way. So many times when I have these discussions or I think about this, I feel like the character played by Keanu Reeves in The Matrix in the first film of that trilogy, where he's brought in by the agents to be interrogated, and he demands his phone call. He says, "You can't scare me with these Nazi tactics. I know my rights. I want my phone call." And the agent responds, "Well, that's all very good, but how do you expect to be able to make a phone call if you're unable to speak?" And the scene proceeds with this sort of very sci-fi, surreal moment where his mouth seals over. And I feel that so often when I try to trudge through documents like this white paper and then share with others, you know, I feel this sort of shortness of breath, unable to speak. You know, it's very difficult to, you're, as with the documentation of the killing of Martin Luther King. You know, there are 13 volumes that of documentation that contradicted the executive report. A lot like the compound image of young woman and old woman that contradict each other. You know, you can see only one image at the same time, at one time. You cannot see both images at the same time. That's the theory anyway. You're familiar with the image, very famous, right? You can fix on the lines that denote the young woman, or you can fix on the lines that denote the old woman. It seems similarly to me what we're given, that this is sort of the rubric that governs the logic of these government deceptions. You're forced to look at one set of lines that are saliently logical, and although your mind is aware those lines can denote another configuration, you're loath to contemplate it because it takes a lot of work, because it requires you to mine into various legalese and documents you have no access to. I mean, there's volumes and volumes and volumes of them. You know, it would take lifetimes and lifetimes to get to the bottom of a single case in many instances. And it's that sense of despair, I think, Stephen, that you know, programs like yours and attempts by others to write makes so incredibly important. I don't know what more to add to that.
Well, I have very strong feelings about it, Matt. I watch so closely because of what I do. Again, I literally put out articles on a daily basis. I follow world and national news, and the stuff that's going on absolutely appalls me. I have a little bit of an advantage over younger people because I can look back to a previous time when, as I like to say, America was never beautiful. It certainly isn't beautiful now. But it was so different in so many ways, the country that I grew up in. I mean, I had opportunities that simply don't exist today. The police state laws that are on the books today weren't there when I grew up. At the same time, government could go after anybody they wanted to. They certainly did. You could go back way before I was born, Sacco and Vincenti going after people because of their beliefs, challenging authority. I mean, we had the Espionage Act under Woodrow Wilson. I mean, literally putting people in prison because they didn't like the idea of America getting into World War I. Well, I mean, I say this kind of stuff all the time, being strongly anti-war, but the Espionage Act could target people then, could target people now. It's being used now to go after people now. To say that they're committing espionage or treason or anti-American acts, call it anything they want. Use the provisions. And if this happened under Woodrow Wilson, Democrat, some Democrat. It happened under other presidents. Then you could go back to the 19th century, horrors happened. So it's always happened, but it's so much more intense now. And it's like the mask is almost entirely off. And even though it's off, most people don't recognize it. And it doesn't matter whether we've got Bush around or Obama around. We've got the Patriot Act. We've got the Homeland Security Act. We've got the National Defense Authorization Act, 2012, a year ago, renewed this past December, that anybody can be arrested. Any U.S. citizen can be arrested anywhere in the world by the military. They can be thrown in a military dungeon. They can be left there indefinitely uncharged. But if they're charged, they'll be tried in a military tribunal. No civil justice, no due process, no habeas rights, no rights whatsoever. Guilty by accusation is the way I like to describe it. That existed when I grew up, but nothing like the way it is today. It simply wasn't abused to the same extent. If that doesn't bother people, and the fact that anybody could be gone after, I don't know what does bother people, along with what's being done to us social justice-wise. I grew up paying insurance premiums for Medicare and Social Security. Both of them are being destroyed in real time. And I say unequivocally, in a decade probably, the way those programs exist today, they won't in that time frame or sooner. They may be entirely gone. They'll probably be privatized along the way. That's a death sentence. Privatization is a death sentence, and that's what's planned. So no social justice, no peace, no civil rights, no human rights. That's the true picture of America, Matt. Again, I say, if that doesn't bother people, what does?
You know, the Scahill and being interviewed by Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez on Democracy Now! Again had some very incisive comments with regard to the Brennan confirmation hearing. He pointed out that Anwar Awlaki, the American killed, his son killed, and another American who FBI, he was affiliated with Awlaki, but FBI made clear to Samir Khan, was it? I have to go back and look at the name, but that the FBI had no evidence that he was and had no interest in him as a conspirator, as of terrorism. He was killed. These were Awlaki was American citizen. His son was American citizen. I'm not sure about Samir, whether he was American citizen. I believe there were three American citizens killed in that time, including Awlaki and his son. His son was 16-year-old son killed, having dinner with friends, hit by a drone attack. Scahill makes a point that what was really despicable about the hearings was under Feinstein's authority to indict Awlaki after the fact based on hearsay evidence. Here the man's been killed, you know, extrajudicially, denied any of the rights guaranteed under constitutional law in the United States, not to mention international law, but that in fact what's going on here is an after-in-fact indictment of an American citizen because of how grave are the implications of this of these actions, that under the banner of a pro forma nomination proceeding, there can be an indictment after the fact of someone killed extrajudicially who was an American. I mean, it doesn't take much imagination to put together the pieces that this is laying the track for establishing precedent that Americans can be killed anywhere, including American soil. Now, Senator Ron Wyden tried to raise this, or it appeared he tried, but he did not push the point. He had good questions, but he didn't follow up the way he ought to have followed up with pressing Brennan on this matter. He let him off the hook. Besides being disgusting what they have done and abhorrent, the implications are horrifying. They're horrifying. We're talking now about, on American soil, the government's ability to kill us, with drone attacks on our own soil. That's what's being, that is the track that has been laid. The claims, the lawyering up, the larding up of white papers with arcane legal precedent that is a very, very dubious ideology in terms of constitutional law. You know, this patchwork of case law, occasional Supreme Court decisions, this pastiche of narrative of unilateral executive authority, justifying unilateral executive authority. This is horrifying, Stephen. What we've done around the world is abhorrent, and you know, sort of, there's no words can describe the crimes against humanity. What we are now ginning up the authority to do on our own people, it seems to me, is of another sort of order magnitude. You know, it takes us into a startlingly brave new world. And this, I think, is where people are actually fearful and numb. So they become, a good friend of mine tells me a story, I'll tell you. He was out on the beach with his wife, and they're talking about these affairs of what the state is up to and what can get away with. And the wife suddenly becomes very startled and says, "Well, you shouldn't be talking about that out loud." They're on the beach, the waves are lapping. You know, in a moment, in an unguarded moment, there's this sense of, you know, of panopticon surveillance constantly. And, you know, thinking about it more than a moment, she would, of course, realize, what was I thinking? But in that moment, there's, you know, I think what is the pandemic. I can tell you, sharing with my own friends, intelligent, educated guys, college-educated, good liberals, good people. You know, the reaction to raising questions on this matter is alarming. You know, the unwillingness to you know, on the one hand, they're willing to accept a certain amount of, well, that's worrisome. But when you start peeling some of the layers really back to the nub, they, you know, the messenger becomes the problem. The child's no longer innocent. The child is a conspiracy nut. The child is deluded. You know, under those conditions, there is no innocent anymore. There is no innocent bystander. We at that point, we are the gas chamber society. You know, we've talked previously about Noam Chomsky and the remarkable reticence of him to call a spade a shovel. You had a chance, I think, to speak or debate with him years ago. You're much more familiar with his approach in these matters, but I heard him recently discuss how, he dismissed the Occupy movement and the police reaction to that as nothing to be that was very worrisome, certainly not compared to the 60s. In the documentary, The Corporation, a really excellent documentary that assembles many, many critical voices and a very, very ecumenical analysis and a judicious analysis of the corporation as a force and entity in our lives, Chomsky was interviewed, and he, in sizing up the corporation, he says, well, you know, corporations nominally are neutral instruments. They could be used for good or evil. You know, under the right conditions, any one of us could be a saint or a gas chamber attendant. And I think here, again, Chomsky has it very, very wrong. I think under conditions that we are facing now, we are all gas chamber attendants. We are, to the extent there is no one anymore among us who's innocent, we're all gas chamber attendants. You know, what's going on, the documents that came out in Freedom of Information Act about the Occupy movement that the recently disclosed, there was a petition made by Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. And they received heavily redacted documents, making clear the extent to which the state has been involved. I hear your music going.
Oh, indeed. We do need to take a break. We're a little bit past the bottom of the hour. Let's do that, Matt, and we'll come right back. Hold your thought.
Will do.
On with Matthew. With Matt, one more comment I'd like to make about the Brennan hearings. In my first article after the hearings, I said the Intelligence Committee senators didn't lay a glove on Brennan, but it really doesn't matter much about how tough or soft or in between they are during the confirmation session, the Q&A, whatever they do. The bottom line is how they feel, what they intend to do, how they will vote. If they stood for what's right against what's wrong, which they absolutely do not, it would be unanimity rejection of this guy. He's a killer.
Yeah.
He's a criminal.
Yeah.
He should be prosecuted. He should be indicted. He should be prosecuted.
Yeah.
He should be convicted. He should be imprisoned. Nothing less is acceptable. But they're going to unanimously confirm him. I would bet. Oh, they could be. Maybe a Republican might say no. I'd be surprised if any does. And the whole Senate, there's no question the Senate will approve him. And one more comment. The late Chalmers Johnson, who once was a consultant to the CIA, and he had plenty to say about it, he completely went the other way and realized the stuff that was going on was destroying the country, destroying democracy, destroying freedoms in every respect. And basically, he said, he wrote that trilogy, and I reviewed one of his books, Nemesis. I believe it was in that book, but he wrote two others, Blowback. I forget the title of the third one. Anyway, there was a third title as well, but I reviewed Nemesis. And
The Sorrows of Empire.
Sorrows of Empire, exactly. I had comments to make about that one, too. He basically said it is impossible for a democracy and a CIA to coexist. You can either have a chance for one. If you have the other, there is no possibility of democracy now. It's a force unto itself. It can do anything it wants. It takes full advantage. Anybody who dares get in its way, they'll just get rid of them. And there are such good examples. Jack Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, dare I go on.
You know, and now Occupy.
Occupy, for sure.
Freedom Information Act indicates the extent to which there was broad coordination between financial institutions, banks in particular, the FBI and local law enforcement, in surveilling, infiltrating, cracking down, intimidating that movement. Now, you know, when we canvass our discussion here today and so much of the work you do, I, as I was contemplating our chat today, Stephen, I was struck by a realization. You know, the First Amendment, the right to assemble, the right to petition, the authorities, this right really is sort of thrust into bold relief now, as we see and how integrally tied that right is to the other Bill of Rights, in particular the Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendments, and of course the 14th Amendment, Substitute Process Clause after Civil War. But, you know, the crackdown on Occupy was justified. You see in an otherwise heavily redacted document, you can see there's clearly this thread presumptive threat of terrorist activity. You know, now, since 9/11, everything that is a threat to to the standard operating procedures of capital and finance can be imputed to be terrorist. And so what was particularly worrisome, clearly, from this very, very murky network of corporate authority and FBI and local law enforcement and Joint Terrorism Task Force and so on, is that Occupy on the West Coast was making common cause with longshoremen and other port labor, and that the threat that would pose was enough to warrant very, very systematic crackdown and sort of, as it were, state espionage. And as you know, I've been doing some background on this, preparing articles for Occupy. I'm very interested in what that movement signified for a state in facing grave, as Jürgen Habermas would say, legitimation crises. And I'm building a point here in my work that there was a concurrent sort of dual processing of legislation that on the one hand dismantled financial regulation in our country, overlapping concurrently with the rise of so-called anti-terrorism legislation. And so you have knocking out the pins of New Deal safeguards against criminal financial activity on the one hand throughout the 1980s and 1990s and into culminating around 1999, concurrent with overlapping, effective anti-terrorism and effective death penalty act under Clinton, then the Patriot Act, and so on forward. It seems to me these trove of legislation are closely tied to one another, to where we have financial wilding on an epic scale, concurrent with crackdown on peaceful protest over the consequences of that wilding. And, under that, in that context, what the First Amendment represents, I think, needs to be revisited. That which we'd otherwise think is safe and sound really is not safe and sound. Along with, of course, the Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Eighth Amendments, having to do with speedy trial, search and seizure, habeas corpus, inhuman punishment, torture, and so on. We need to identify, I think, as a sort of intellectuals observing this stuff, we need to begin identifying with a forensic approach sort of what's going on here. These are state crimes against democracy, as my good friend, colleague, Lance Haven Smith has coined. That's what's going on here. It seems difficult to get our heads around, well, what's a state crime and how could democracy itself be the victim? But I think that we're fast approaching sort of a time where the breakdown in syntax that permits transacting meaning between us as human beings is upon us. When we get the Kabuki Theater, what Scahill calls Kabuki hearings, for the Brennan nomination, a killer, pathological liar, that type of guy is going to be confirmed probably unanimously by our body of the people. With no scrutiny over truth claims made by this individual, other than pro forma, superficial scrutiny. This is the pretense of democracy. This is the pretense of due process. This is the pretense of advice and consent. Under those conditions, symbol is everything. And symbol has always been pertinent in political drama, of course. It's very, very, that's as old as the hills. But where symbol becomes so corrosive of the means by which a people can substantiate truth claims, where symbol it undermines the basis for why symbol has any value whatsoever. We have a snake eating its tail kind of situation. And And I think that we're, you know, language itself is under attack by this drama, this this kabuki theater. Meaning-making among us is under attack. Shock and awe that subdues our ability to transact meaningful discussions with loved ones and friends and peers and colleagues, because there's this hush that emerges immediately among otherwise judicious, thoughtful people when it comes to questions of the most dire portent, which has to do with what we're discussing here, and that you and I are, in a sense, consigned to an ironically private discussion over a public airwave. I say private because, you know, your best intentions notwithstanding, and God bless the efforts you undertake with others, that the call and response that ought to be elicited from that is a very muted one, if at all. You know, under this, I wasn't alive during the McCarthy era. I'm 50 years old now. I just turned 50, so I was born in 1962. JFK was killed a year later. I don't have any, you know, I remember when and where I was when John Lennon was killed. That's my generation.
I certainly remember the day Kennedy was killed, Matt, and I very much grew up in the McCarthy era, and it was televised. The hearings were televised, and sometimes in the afternoon when I was able to get in front of a TV set, I would watch some of them, and I watched the hearing when the lawyer who defended the army private, was he? That McCarthy was waging war in the army and on this private, I forget his name, and Joe Welch took on McCarthy and some of his famous lines, including "Have you no decency, Senator?" something like that. And it's been a while, but I've quoted what he said in an article. But I actually saw that live on TV. It was a very, very dramatic moment, and it was the death knell for Joe McCarthy. Joe Welch, in his sincere, professional, I would say low-key way, he certainly didn't rant, but he really went after McCarthy, and he caught him in a vulnerable moment, and he took him down, and he destroyed McCarthy's career. He was censured by the Senate, and a few years later he died. I just can't imagine that stuff happening today, Matt, where a guy like McCarthy would probably have free rein to do what he wants. I mean, if you let a killer have free rein to do whatever he wants, you certainly could let McCarthy go after so-called communists that don't exist. Throughout McCarthy's whole career, he never found a single communist, certainly found nobody to threaten America, but he scared a lot of people, and he scared a lot of people in the Senate, and he got away with some horrible stuff before Joe Welch, a lawyer nobody ever heard of. I never heard of him. Joe Welch brought him down, and literally a few years later, he was dead.
I hear you, and your point well taken is that try to imagine that occurring now. First of all, there is no singular Joe McCarthy. There is a shadowy network of individuals whose profile emerges, as with Brennan, and then recedes quickly into the background before one can peg any particular, peg any particular persona to them. There was Cheney, who was high profile for very high profile under Bush, and then of course in the background going all the way back to Nixon along with Rumsfeld. Their careers aligned and spiraled together for decades. But for the most part, we don't have individuals who, when finally receive their comeuppance, there goes likewise the symbols that they parlayed. We don't have that now. And it's we are in a, as I've said, Morwellian time, more than Orwell. It seems to me what Americans will do, I think, Stephen, is the big question. You know, at what point, when will we have our Welch, was it?
Yeah, Joe Welch.
When will we have our Joe Welch moment? When will the American voice emerge higher than a murmur? Have you no decency, CIA? Have you no decency, President, whomever you are? Have you no decency, Congressional Oversight Committee? Have you no decency, Supreme Court? You know, when will America have a channel that is clear and speaking language that everyone understands at the right moment? You know, it's nice to imagine, but hard to conceive.
Yeah, it's,
when
so,
that time
it's so tough to have a Joe Welch moment today, if for no other reason. Back then, in the early 1950s, there were three TV channels, you know, three broadcasters, and public broadcasting, I think, came. I forget when public broadcasting started. I think there was something local that there was public broadcasting. So let's say there were four channels. But literally, instead of soap operas or whatever they have on in the afternoon, they put the McCarthy hearings on. You know, now the cable channels would be running things like O.J. trials and stuff like that. You know, nonsense stuff. I mean, trials are important, but to devote broadcasting to this stuff hour after hour after hour, but to show something like the McCarthy hearings, I mean, that was history that you were watching. So it was an extraordinary moment for me to be able to witness this and actually remember it all these years later. But they don't do that now. They would never broadcast this stuff now. They broadcast a confirmation hearing on cable channels. You know, the kind of stuff that you see this kabuki theater as you describe it, Matt. But you'd never get a situation where you could get a Joe Welch moment. And if something like that arose, they'd probably cut it short, so people really wouldn't see what was going on. So we may never have a moment like that again, unless people do something to defend their own interest. And there's a word for that. I don't believe in violence, but there's a word for that, and it's called revolution. And I certainly hope something will happen to change where we're going, because my God, I can't imagine how bad things will get. This program probably won't exist in a lot more. Not only won't there be a Joe Welch moment, Matt, but programs like this will be pulled off the air because we tell the truth. That scares me.
Yeah, it's. Yeah, you know, I it seems when you mentioned the point about cable stations, I think it's very, very important for us to realize to speculate how we've entered a new era of babble. That, you know, there are so many languages spoken, as it were, and they propagate such a tower of incoherent babble. That, you know, the public tunes out. That's the defeat of language. The parable is many, many tongues spoken. But we can derive from the parable, I think, lesson for our time.
Matt, let me just interrupt you one moment. I think we've got about 2 minutes or so left.
Sure.
So I want to give it to you with anything you really want to get across to listeners before we get off. Take the time and focus on what you think is most important that you haven't covered so far.
Well, I think maybe it is this point that Americans need to listen with a decoder in their minds over what it is they're hearing and what it is true and where they need to find valid information. The parable of Babel is that regardless of the language spoken, what is said is irrelevant. It becomes irrelevant because it saturates all airwaves. There's an incoherent mishmash of entertainment, infotainment, cheap thrills, and then the occasional buried lead, which is a confirmation hearing that is, as Jeremy Scahill says, kabuki theater. We as Americans have to listen differently. I'm not Christian, but I think that Christ's dictum, who among us have ears to hear? You know, these are the times we're in, Stephen. And I try to urge whoever will listen that there are patterns emerging here that are very, very, very clear and distinctive, totalitarian patterns that are emerging. And we've got to figure out how to assemble ourselves into a coherent phalanx to resist that, one way or the other.
That is so, so true. A very important thing to end the program on. I really thank you for coming on. I look forward to having you back. This is such big stuff. I just can't imagine anything bigger than this. Our personal freedoms, are we willing to see them taken away from us? I didn't grow up in Nazi Germany. I sure read a lot about it. The kind of stuff that I read, some of it was extremely graphic and traumatic. There's no way I'd ever want to be in a country like that, whether I'm Jewish or anything else. But that's the path America is on. I've just got time to wrap up and tell my listeners to please join us again tomorrow. We're on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Tune in each week. Tune in each program. Follow information like this. It's the only defense we have. Make it a regular habit.